Welcome to the CBWC Theology for the Ordinary podcast on the Book of Revelation. I'm Cindy Emmons, and I'm here with Mark Dirksen and Ed Neufeld. Ed will lead us as we attempt to understand and apply the Book of Revelation in our own context. You're listening to Episode 9 on Revelation chapters 14 and the first part of chapter 15.
This is the second half of Holy War, Holy War 2. And we will start with Revelation 12, 17. Chapters 12 to 14 and actually into the beginning of chapter 15:4 describe holy war in which we find ourselves. And we are all in this war in one way or another. So the Bible is written to answer, I think, the important questions. And one of the questions, a basic one, is, what's really going on? What's really going on? And this war scene, holy war, is given us to see that. I have said that Revelation 4 and 5, the throne room vision, is actually the most central vision of the book of Revelation. If you can grasp what's going on in Revelation 4 and 5, that's the key message. But if we stand back a little bit, there are four key visions in Revelation, it seems to me. The first one is the exalted Christ in chapter 1, who walks among the churches and holds them in his right hand, that Christ of Daniel 7. So that's the starting point. So the churches are good. And then there is the throne room vision of chapter 4 and 5. And then this holy war, the seven scenes describing the whole battle in chapter 14, 12 to 14. Is the third one, and then there's the new heaven and the new earth at the end. So those four kind of hold up the book. So I'm going to review a little bit because it seems a shame to just do half of this holy war. So I'm going to review a little bit from what we did the last session. Revelation 12, the whole chapter, is scene one. And beginning in Revelation 13, 1, we read in Greek, "and I saw." Six more times we read, "and I saw," from 13:1 to 15:2. And so they're not the same necessarily in English translation, but in Greek they are. And so those six "and I saw" introductions give us scenes 2 to 7. And these scenes take us from just before the birth of Christ, when the woman is in childbirth labor, to praising God in scene 7 after all the rescue and judgment have happened. So the battle, scenes 1 to 3 describe the battle. Who's fighting against who? Why are they fighting? What are they fighting about? What are the weapons? That's scenes 1 to 3. And 4 to 7 describe consequences, basically, of the battle. So here's what we read in the first scene. The dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to wage war against the rest of her offspring, those who keep God's commands and hold fast their testimony about Jesus. So that's the warfare, and that's in scene 1. So we are those who keep God's commands and hold on to our confession of Christ. So that means the dragon is at war with us. So how did that come to be? Who is the dragon? Who is the woman? Why is he angry? Why is he coming after us? So scene 1 answers those. The woman is God's people, faithful Israel, and faithful church, all viewed here as one woman. And the dragon is the ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. And in scene 1, and this is important, in scene 1, the dragon loses 3 times. Okay? If we will give Revelation a chance, there's a huge amount of encouragement, and there are far more teachings of encouragement in Revelation than frightening ones for God's people. Scene 1 gives us the 3 losses of the dragon. 1, he tried to destroy the Christ, but he failed. Christ is safe with God on his throne. 2, the dragon fought to keep his own place in heaven, but he lost the fight, and he and his angels were thrown down. And 3, the dragon tried to destroy the woman, the people of God, but God protects the woman. He cannot destroy the woman. cannot destroy the people of God. Three losses, and his time is short. All he can do is go after individual believers, and that he does. So he wages war with the rest of her offspring, those who keep God's commands and hold fast their testimony about Jesus. And that is how we got to be in holy war. That's how the first scene describes that. So scenes 2 and 3 describe the shape of the war. And scene 2, which is chapter 13, 1 to 10, shows a dragon arranging a beast. He will rule the nations. 13:4 says that people worship the dragon and the beast. That's a key line. They worship the beast, and they said, who can wage war against the beast? Who can fight authority and power like that? Nobody can fight him. He's too big and strong. So they worship the beast. So think about our king. He arranged to ride into Jerusalem on a donkey, fulfilling Zechariah's old prophecy about a humble Israelite king arriving like that. So he came in on a donkey. He never explained or said a word. He waited to see who would figure out what he was telling the world. We could not find a bigger contrast between the method of Christ and God on the one hand and the beast and the dragon on the other hand. So that's how he comes. And scene 3 tells us about the second beast, who is the first beast's enforcer. The second beast uses authority to make everyone worship the first beast. And later in Revelation, the second beast is called the false prophet. So God has prophets, people who give his messages, and so does the beast. So in the first century, emperor worship was common. It was enforced more strictly by some Caesars than others, depending on how paranoid that particular Caesar was. But John's churches know all about bowing down to worship the image of a world ruler. That's common. They know exactly what this is talking about. And people did it sometimes willingly. And when the pressure was on, then they did it because it was pressure. So the first beast is Caesar, and the second beast, the false prophet, is whatever local people are making sure this happens. And there's no ambiguity about any of that in the first century. So at the end of scene 3, at the end of Revelation 13, gives us important new information. The beast is human. Nothing in the rest of Revelation 13 prepared us for that. He's a monster out of the sea. He's a leopard and a bear and a lion. Yes, he's all of that, and he's human. And the name on the forehead describes who we worship. God's people have God's name and God's lamb on the foreheads because that's who we worship. The beast himself has blasphemous names on his forehead, and John will not write what's on that forehead. But his followers have 666 on their foreheads. And it's the human number because God created people on the sixth day. It's a good number. It's not a bad number. Humans were made in the image and likeness of God. But from one image of God to worship another is foolish and blasphemous. And not only that, people are forced to worship an image of a human. So we worship an image of an image of God. So what they have on their foreheads is human, human, human. That's what the 666 says, because they worship a human. So no one can see God's name on our foreheads. It's real, but it's not part of the material world. And I expect the 666 on their foreheads would be understood the same way. John got the seal on the forehead originally of the 144,000 from the vision of Ezekiel, and there's no actual mark on the righteous, foreheads of the righteous that we could see either. At some level there is in the spiritual realm, but there's not here. Even if there is some material mark, we don't have to worry about this sneaking up on us. It'll be a very conscious choice. I am being bullied into worshiping something not God. So I remember when it was credit cards. Man, it's been a lot of things in my days. All the stuff that we were actually worshiping the beast. So it won't be that. If you're worshiping God and the Lamb and you mean it, then don't you worry about stuff like that. There's just a lot of paranoia about this actually. It's not accidental. So that's the battle. And the battle is about worship. That's the thing. People worship the dragon because he gave authority. All the inhabitants of the earth worship the beast. The second beast made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast. All who refuse to worship the image of the beast will be killed. Those are the battle lines. We're talking about worship here. And the number on the forehead simply reflects a worship choice. Now, all of that's reviewed. Scene 4 is the Song of the Redeemed, which is a preview of Scene 7. So I'm here now in Revelation 14, verses 1 to 5. This is Scene 4. It's the Song of the Redeemed, and it's a preview of Scene 7. So it's in the middle of the seven scenes, this Scene 4, but it's pretty much the same as Scene 7. It's as if John could not wait to get to the happy ending, so he gave us half of the happy ending in the middle of the story. And then when we get to Scene 7, he gives us the other half of the happy ending. So in Scene 4, people are playing music and singing in front of God. And in Scene 7, the same people are in the same place, also playing music and singing. And in Scene 7, we get the words to the song. We don't get the words in Scene 4, but we do in Scene 7. Back in Revelation 7, when we were first introduced to the 144,000, John heard the number, 144,000 from the 12 tribes, and then he saw a huge crowd. So what he saw and what he heard were two different descriptions of the same thing. 144,000 symboled all God's people. So here, he first saw and then he heard. So in the fourth scene, John saw the 144,000 with the Lamb's name and his Father's name on their foreheads. And then he heard a sound, the singing of a huge crowd. But what he hears is the singing of the 144,000. There's an emphasis here on volume. I have been beside a waterfall a few times with somebody else. And the only way I could have a conversation was to put my mouth about 4 inches from their ear and shout. That's the only way you can hear anything, you can understand anything. That's how I imagine this, rushing waters. Then you have to imagine a severe thunderstorm going on at the same time. That's what John says. So the volume is incredible. And what is he actually hearing? He's hearing harpists playing their harps and God's people singing to God. And you and I will be there. We're in this great choir. Do you wish you were a better musician and could sing wonderfully? Boy, I would be very pleased about those two. On that day, we'll have it all and we'll play and sing for God. Silly stuff has happened with harp here. Is there a famous harpist in the Old Testament? There is. It's David. David is the famous harpist in the Old Testament. And so the whole point here is that we are all going to be like David, playing and singing praise to God and composing songs to God. So when goofy stuff has happened with harps, it's not fair. So you think about David in the Old Testament, Israel's sweet musician and a sweet poet playing for God. That's what we relate. So there's been a lot of worship so far in Revelation, but not much music. Music is at the core of Scene 4, musicians and players singing a new song. And why do we have music here? Because nobody sings to the dragon. Nobody sings to the beast. Nobody sings to the image. They will bow and worship. They'll bring offerings, and they'll sell their souls to the dragon and the beast. But no one plays harps, and no one writes a new song, and no one sings. That only happens to the king who came into Jerusalem on a donkey. There is on YouTube a song called "Atheists Don't Have No Songs" by Steve Martin and some folk gospel quartet. You familiar with that? Check it out. That's sort of what's going on here. I don't know what Martin's going on, but it's worth hearing once. "Atheists Don't Have No Song." That's the sentiment behind the contrast here between why people worship the beast and how they do it and how they worship God. They did not defile themselves with women, for they are virgins. So we get a male picture of spiritual faithfulness and then a female image. So the 144,000 are men who did not defile themselves with women. And in the same breath, they are virgins who did not defile themselves with men. So virgin is much debated here. So in the Bible, virgin always refers to women. Except this place, if this is an exception. But it's best not to take this as an exception. It means women as well. Paul told the Corinthian church, I promised you to one husband to Christ so that I could present you as a pure virgin to him. 2 Corinthians 11. So we will take virgins as pure women. The sexual imagery here has to be symbolic. Genesis begins with two creation stories. Did you know that there are actually two stories there? There's Genesis 1, and then there's another story that starts in Genesis 2, about verse 4. And they both end with sexual intimacy between a husband and wife. And in Genesis 1, it is sexual intimacy to produce many children. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And in Genesis 2, sexual intimacy comes as one person divided into two. And then the two coming back, the two halves come back to be one flesh again, because they started out as one flesh. But in different ways, both stories elevate sexual union between a husband and a wife. The Bible also elevates celibacy, Jesus himself and Paul and others. So women who defile and virginity have to be symbolic. There's no way that John is throwing out Genesis 1 and 2. That's just not possible. So there is a rich Old Testament history background of idolatry being viewed as spiritual adultery. There's a lot about that in the Old Testament. That's a common image, and that's what we have here. The sexual faithfulness of men and women is being given us as a picture of no idolatry. So, to summarize, scene 4 is a preview of the end in scene 7. It puts us all before God and the Lamb when it's all over, and we're singing and making music to God with all our might, just as David did on this one. Scene 5. God warns all people. Two worship messages from God. So in scene 5, three angels make announcements to the world, but only the first and the third one use a loud voice. So the middle one is about Babylon. It's a teaser for chapter 17 and 18. We're going to ignore the middle voice. But the first angel with a loud voice preaches the eternal gospel to every nation, tribe, language, and people. And the gospel is, fear God, give him glory, worship the Creator. Fear God, give him glory, worship the Creator. And the other angel with a loud voice, the third angel, warns about ignoring the first angel. Whoever worships the beast and his image and takes his mark will drink the wine of God's fury, which has been poured full strength into the cup of his wrath. So let's go back to the first angel. So this is a loud voice. God himself has been calling people to worship him all along. In Romans 1, Paul says it comes from creation. And in John's gospel, Jesus teaches that the Spirit will convict the world of sin and righteousness and judgment. So what we have to imagine is that God is doing a lot of calling of the world that is not dependent on human voices. He is out there through creation and through his Spirit, and he's urging people to worship him and not to rebel. In Revelation, there's no clear evidence of evangelism going on here. That was not the emphasis of any of the seven letters. So that there's certainly some of that happening, but that's not the emphasis. So here it is, the voice is actually coming from God. I think different people will actually experience that in different ways. But we need to take this at face value, that God has a message and it's going out, and he is calling people to himself. So I'm going to read the third angel's warning in full, because it is unpleasant enough that we don't talk about it. So this is the third warning in scene 5, I'm going to read, started at Revelation 14, verse 9. The third angel followed and said in a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast and its image and receives its mark on their forehead or on their hand, they too will drink the wine of God's fury, which has been poured full strength into the cup of his wrath. They will be tormented with burning sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and of the Lamb, and the smoke of their torment will rise forever. There will be no rest day or night for those who worship the beast and its image, or for anyone who receives the mark of the name. This calls for patient endurance on the part of the people of God who keep his commands and remain faithful to Jesus. And then I heard a voice from heaven say, write this, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, they will rest from their labor, their deeds will follow it. So some will rest and some will not. This punishment is symbolic. Most of Revelation says it's symbolic. The next scene describes the great winepress of God's wrath, which is quite a different picture. We're relieved that it's symbolic because we say, well, it won't be that bad. But we don't have any right to do that. So we don't know how bad it'll be, but it'll be pretty bad. The second angel tells us that although there will be troubles for those who don't worship the beast, there will be far greater troubles for those who don't worship God. You know, fear. I've been urged not to use fear in preaching. It's not a good way to motivate people. But I'll tell you, you read through Matthew and you just underline all of the judgment teachings of Jesus himself in Matthew. It is sobering. I'll tell you, maybe we're not supposed to use fear, but Jesus had no qualms about that. He did not. I don't know. I have what I sort of assumed about Jesus and the God of the New Testament has been taken away. So anyway, Jesus did not mind using fear. That's just how it is. And if you don't believe me, take a good look at the judgment teachings in Matthew. And that's what Revelation is doing here. I mean, Jesus says, don't fear those who can destroy the body and after that got nothing to do. You're the one who can destroy body and soul. In different words, this is exactly what John is doing. If fear is going to guide us, people, if fear is going to guide us, at least have the wits to fear the greater evil. Okay? If fear is going to guide you, if you're going to make your choice based on fear, at least have the wits to fear the greater evil. That's what John is doing, and Jesus did the same thing. That's not the emphasis, but it's in there, and they don't hide it. Scene 6. The Lord harvests the righteous and the rebels. So scene 6 is chapter 14, verses 14 to 20. There are two final harvests here. The next step after the warning. So in scene 5, we had the warnings, the gospel and the warnings. Two harvests in scene 6. So there are a little bit. The first one is dubious. The second harvest of scene 6 is clear, though. It's God's wrathful punishment on those who won't worship him. They worship someone else. So that's the second harvest. And the first harvest then becomes clearer. It's Christ gathering his own people to himself. So there before me was a white cloud, and on the cloud one like a son of man. So the cloud here is God's presence. And John is quoting from Daniel 7, his favorite Old Testament chapter. I saw one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. And Jesus says almost the same time, people will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory, and he will send his angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the four ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. So that's the first harvest scene. 1 Thessalonians 4, the Lord himself will come down from heaven with a shout and with a loud command, and people will be caught up with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air and so on. So that's the first harvest. So the second final harvest is the rest of humanity and those destined for God's wrath, pictured here as a grape harvest. So it's gruesome. Instead of grapes being trampled, people are trampled and blood flows. So after the two witnesses are taken up in Revelation 11, remember? After the two witnesses, there was great judgment. So that's the pattern here as well. Scene six takes us to final judgment. We have come to final judgment already in the sixth seal, and we have come to final judgment several times along the way here, and this is another one of those. So, the Song of the Redeemed, scene seven, is now in proper sequence. We finish up what we began in the fourth scene. John sees a sea of glass, and standing beside it, those who are victorious over the beast and its image, and they sing a song of Moses. So, think about this. Old Testament. They are standing beside the sea, and they're singing a song of Moses. Does that remind you of anything? So, Israel walked through the Red Sea, and then they watched their powerful enemies destroyed, and then they sang. And that's exactly what's going on here. In Revelation, the only time God's people use harps is in scene four and scene seven, and that's what's going on here. So that's one reason I'm pretty sure we've got two different pictures of the same event in scene four and scene seven. And the other reason is that in scene four, we learn about music and singing, but we don't find out what they sing. In Revelation, that's unusual. But in scene seven, we get the words, which we take to be the words of the singing in scene four. Great and marvelous are your deeds, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are your ways, King of the nations. Who will not fear you, Lord, and bring glory to your name? You alone are holy. All nations will come and worship you. Your righteous acts have been revealed. So worship in Revelation means give God clear, direct credit for what he has done. We tell God that he is great, and we tell him why. That is what worship is, and most of the worship in the Psalms has the same kind of theme. We tell him that he is great, and we tell him why. Give him credit. That's what worship is. Give him credit. Name him for who he is and what he has done. That is consistent in Revelation. After all this is over, we will be unbelievably impressed that he was true, that he was faithful, and that he was just. And that's what makes him great and marvelous. And we'll sing to him with all our hearts. And that's where this ends. So holy war started before the birth of Christ. And this is where it ends. We will worship the one who told the world he was the king by riding into Jerusalem on a donkey. And we will be so delighted with how it turned out that we can't not sing. That's how it will be. Amen. Holy war is done.
What role does orthodoxy or correct doctrine or correct belief, what role do they have in rightly persevering?
Significant errors in teaching cause troubles in the church, cause weaknesses and vulnerability. On the other hand, there are people who get quite a bit wrong and they love the Lord and they worship God. And in Revelation, the worship choice is the main thing. To worship God and the Lamb, the Creator and the Lamb, and not quit worshiping the Creator and the Lamb. And that is the key. In Revelation, that is the key to our survival. And when we move from that, we're in trouble. So the assumption is it's going to be long and difficult and require patience and endurance. But in Revelation, it's mostly worship.
The second question is that the commentator Beale suggests that the devil and his agents use the world economic system to ensnare people through their love of money and material pleasures. Yet there are many presently who follow Christ who also have lots of wealth and material possessions and pleasures. So what advice would the book of Revelation have for them as they ponder their wealth and its meaning?
There's a line dealing with the prostitute. Come out from her so you don't share her punishments. The line from Revelation is, get out of there. It's not going to be pretty. So economic realities are in there. The Bible does not call things idolatry that are not actually worship choices. So people may be, we can say, well, your house is your idol or your car is your idol or whatever you got, your wardrobe is your idol. And the Bible sees those things as problems and distractions, but it doesn't call them idols. It only calls idols when we're actually worshiping something. There's very little of that. So we sometimes get free and easy with that. However, there is, I think Ephesians and Colossians say that greed is a kind of idolatry. So it's a problem. And in Revelation, it's a problem. And people can't buy or sell without the beast. So it will affect conduct. The stuff is dangerous. Jesus thought wealth was dangerous. So I think it's a problem. And the short story from Revelation is get out of there. Save yourself.
All right. And I have a question from verses 9 to 11 of chapter 14. These verses present a disturbing picture of the fate of those who worship the beast. So how do we properly, maybe, and honestly present this concept to those just beginning to seek to follow Christ, but I think also reminding those who maybe don't want to think about this very much as they follow Christ?
Yeah, I know it's a problem. And that's one of the reasons I read it over and talked about it a little bit. Not only do we not want to hear it, we have convinced ourselves that it is in bad taste to talk about it and that it just turns people off. So I don't know what to do about that. When Paul preached to pagan Gentiles in Acts 14 and 17, he was unbelievably kind. And he's basically told them, God has been feeding you and taking care of you and putting good things in your life all these years, even though you didn't know him and didn't pay any attention. So now you need to turn to the God that's been watching over you, because the time of ignorance is over. Now he sent his son and there's going to be a judgment. So turn to the God that's been good to you. The gospel there is interesting. So it's a different way of presenting it. So I don't know that there's a right or a wrong way to do this. When he preached to Jewish synagogues, there was some kind of a warning there. Like, if you don't return to the Lord, this is not going to go well for you. At least that much is a pretty regular part of the gospel. A little bit needs to be in there. But after that, I don't know, except it's not right that we're squeamish, and it's not right that it cannot be spoken of forthrightly in churches. It needs to be done. Because Jesus did it, and so did Revelation. And that's not the only place. So it does happen there. Cindy, do you have any?
Not really. His marks were better than mine. But when I was reading it, verses 9 to 11 obviously stand out to me because they're awful. But it just reminds me of the armor of God and how important that is in our part. Like, God's part is all of it, really. God's doing all of it, and we mostly just have to hold on for the bumpy ride.
Yeah, that's correct.
I don't like some of this, Ed, but I think, even as you mentioned before, it's not a matter of liking it.
No, it's good to know where the world is headed.
Yeah.
It's good to know where the world is headed. At the start of my teaching, I defended God from all the bad implications of these scriptures and found ways for it not to be as bad as it sounded. And there was too much, I realized. And furthermore, he does not seem awkward about this at all. He's not asking me to make him look nicer than he is. So I'm not going to do that. And if people don't like him and walk away, well, then you don't like him and walk away. I don't prefer that, but I don't have the right to change the message. And we'll talk about this more in the next session. Wrath becomes more prominent in the bowls. We'll talk a little more about that then.
It's much easier to let things go that people have done to you, knowing that God's going to deal with them. Like, oh my goodness, is he going to deal with them?
Mm-hmm.
Not my problem.
No, it's not your problem.
Yeah.
Yes. That's hard to do, but that's the right thing to do. But it does make it easier.
Well, and at the same time, you don't wish it on them, right?
No.
Yeah.
No, actually reading that makes me sad, actually, because yeah. I would pick somewhere in the middle. Like, I just want them to understand what they did and how it affected. But yeah. Oh my goodness, I don't want anybody to get that.
No.
Even the way you and I are described, we were all by nature children of wrath. Wow, I look at you, I look at myself in the mirror. Seems a little strong. For what God does to make sense to me, I just have to turn the volume up on sin and rebellion a little bit. It's worse than what I thought it was, including my own. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's all just worse than what I thought. And if I turn the volume up enough until it makes more sense.
In the end, it'll make more sense, right?
And in the end, it'll make
more sense. We just don't see things clearly right now.
That's right. Very good.
Thanks for joining us. Our next episode will be on the remainder of Revelation chapter 15 and chapter 16.